Today's talk is given by Dr. Paul Norman of the University of Leeds, and his talk is entitled, "I was the Cheshire Cat, but I'm now the Unitary Authority of Warrington Cat." So we're dealing with boundary change, the process and utility of converting socio-demographic data. Dr. Paul Norman is a lecturer in human geography, applied spatial analysis and policy. Research interests include harmonisation of small area level socio-demographic morbidity and mortality data to enable time series analysis of demographic health change, development of small area population estimation methods that incorporate multiple data sources about population subgroups and demographic processes, using area typologies to understand migration patterns and resulting health outcomes, and, amongst others, using individual level microdata to understand aggregate differences in population stratification characteristics over time. A range of interesting problems. On the other hand, Paul also confessed to me earlier that he, well, as well as a keen runner, and you're running off shortly, and he's a fellow reformed bass player and jazzer. That, as well as myself, there's two I've met this month, so I don't know, some connection with GIS. But from his CV, he appears to have, therefore, an interesting career before becoming respectable as a mature student completing his PhD about 2002 at Leeds, and also worked in Manchester for some time. So with much current work in some of the hard-to-do areas of GIS, such as asymmetric mapping and recomputing various statistics, with all that, however, we could not be in better hands to guide us through the maze of boundary changes. So over to Paul.
Thanks, Owen. Thanks very much for the invite. And it's lovely to see so many people when we could be outside enjoying the sunshine, rare though it is. So I'll come back to where that quote comes from right at the end of the talk. But it was just one that amused me, if nothing else. This is a bit of a sort of how to do it in terms of dealing with the boundary change and an assessment of the reliability of the process and so on. So this is where I'm going to be going over the next little while. I'm just going to talk about some examples of zonal systems and why we might need to convert between geographies and express that in terms of the relationships between different geographies. And then I'm going to step through how to go about converting between geographies to show you what you might do were you to undertake this yourself. And think about... It's working on there, Owen. Press a button.
I do have an emergency room.
Would you like to gather around the monitor?
It's a good time to say that I did offer to pay for a service of this high level of use, but that remains to be agreed. It is a hot day, but that excuse I've seen used elsewhere.
They had the lamp warning lights on it, but it's gone off, so... I
fancy just wrecking 201 again. It should be crazy.
Thank you.
filter was cleaned. But so we've got that message.
That's good enough.
Okay. Sit yourself down. Stop sweating. Okay, I'm going to talk then, after explaining some of the terminology to different geographies, about how we might go about the process of converting between different geographies, and to do an appraisal of the utility of the process in a small variety of ways. So that's effectively at that stage, it's all about area data. So you've got data released for aerial geographies, how to cope with having things for different geographies and boundary change over time and things like that. I'm then going to sort of stray into a slightly different area, which is when you have individual level data that might be located by a postcode, to think about what happens when you associate that with geographies and some of the choices that you have at that stage and why that might matter in various kinds of ways. So I'll first be talking about area geographies and then be talking about individuals linked to geographies. So why do we have different geographies? Well, fundamentally, it's to organise and administrate in some ways. And some of these might be traditional geographies. Some of these might be to do with the electoral process. Some of it might be to do with demography, census and vital statistics, and some of it might be functional in some kind of way for particular organisations. And to a large extent, a lot of those types of geographies are underpinned by what is defined for the census, but that isn't actually necessarily true, and census geographies themselves change. So we have a variety of geographies which we might want to do some kind of analysis for, but they don't necessarily align with each other. But why do we have some of those particular zonal systems? Well, lying behind everything is the microdata. There's something about individuals that's then aggregated into those areas. Those areas are then defined for the particular purpose that a particular organisation has. And the geography of the data release, the things that we can actually get, somehow balance what we as users, or perhaps even we, given some of the roles of some of the people in the room, are actually data providers, and some of us will actually do both things. So we need to protect the confidentiality of the individuals who've provided the data, yet have some kind of utility for the research or the administrative process that we're interested in. And that's a bit of a conflict quite often. And not only that, but some of the views on what is disclosive will in itself change over time. And some of this research might link area attributes to an individual's data. So, for example, if we want to know the impact on our health of the level of deprivation of an area, we might link that individual's data to an area that they might live in. In a more general sense, again, in terms of the research and the utility of the work, sorry, I didn't mean to kick you. Many didn't succeed, whereas I did. It's also, in terms of well-informed research, we crash on about you need to know whether it's aggregate data or individual data, is it nominal, ordinal, scale, all that sort of rubbish. You need to know all that, and I would say you need to know about the geography as well, because if you know the geography, you are more likely to do a well-informed piece of work. So I am talking exclusively today about vector GIS, so that's this sort of points, lines, polygons, type of thing. I am not talking as in the sort of more picture element here about raster GIS. I know there's some roads in the background of that. So it's this kind of an arrangement rather than that kind of an arrangement. There are people, for example, Chris Lloyd and his crew in Liverpool are doing quite a similar type of approach of sort of census data over time for raster geographies that I would do for vector geographies. So follow that project if you want to know more about raster. We can convert between vector and raster, or that kind of thing, but I'm not going there. Okay, so why might we need to convert between geographies? Well, official data are not necessarily available for compatible geographies, and there might be many disparate data providers involved. And we might want to merge data sets from different sources which use different geographies, even if they shouldn't, that there should be some kind of agreement on these things. So even, you know, the top four things there, census, vital statistics, electoral, administrative, they have a lot to do with each other in terms of the geographies, but they might make different decisions at different time points and so on. And postal geography is very, very different in a sort of England, Wales, Northern Ireland setting. It's been less different in a Scottish setting over time. But even so, it's a different system. So if we have data from a variety of those sources and we want a common geography to work with, we're probably going to need to make the pieces fit together. And the other aspect to this is boundary change over time, that we might have, say, for example, you know, ward geography from one census to the next. We want to look at change over time, so we really should have something that's comparable in terms of the geography, so we know whether a change that we're interested in is a real change rather than just an artifact of the boundary changes, or all of that locked together. So change over time through a variety of sources and so on. Okay, so apologies that here I am north of the border from somewhere in Yorkshire speaking in a North London accent and that you have a slide of England and Wales. But this is sort of just to get the flavour of the language, that we have census geographies which might therefore be nation to region to local authority district to wards to output areas, that kind of hierarchy. The hierarchies change, the names of the zones change, etc., etc., and different things in the different constituent countries of our United Kingdom. And that's therefore postal geographies, and again, they are a hierarchy, area, district, sector, unit. The area, district, sector are all defined as polygons, and the unit postcode we tend to assume is a point. That's the type of data we can get. In reality, of course, a postcode isn't a point, but that's how we use them in geography speak. Okay, so the ward boundaries change over time, for example. Everything changes over time. I'm going to talk more about wards than anything else today, just show some conversions between them, just for convenience. It's not that this is the only thing that you can do. So this is a fairly classic location, Wenham Hatfield in Hertfordshire, and on the left, as you see it, 1991 ward boundaries, and on the right, the 2001 ward boundaries. And we have all sorts of things going on. The northern bit, where we go from Welling West and Welling East, and later there were Welling South and Welling North. It's actually just about the same area of land, but just subdivided differently. We've got a district boundary change going on at the bottom here. We've got places with the same name that they change, subdivisions, all sorts of things going on. And the ones that are just highlighted in yellow on the right are the ones which actually don't change over time. Well, actually, until I realised putting these slides together, that I've been saying, using this particular slide for some years, giving this example, I found out actually I'm wrong. There's a boundary change which I hadn't noticed in amongst that lot. So we'll leave it that those are just about the same over time, and then I'll show you the difference in a minute. So that's not untypical. It's a fairly extreme example between two censuses, but it's not entirely unusual. And just to show you, or not show you, as the case may be, how is room 201? Or is it 101?
Should we move on, or is this going to happen at the...
Carry on a second, I'm going to set it up the other room.
Okay. Well, as you can see, postal geography doesn't align with census geography. Thank you, my man. Is he Debbie McGee?
You will set it up, and I'll move people through when this comes back. Is it going to come back on?
Well, you need
it. Okay, well, you all know that census geography doesn't align with postal geography, except some of Scotland, where it does. So you're better off in Scotland. Okay, what that is showing is just some of the changes of terminology and some of the names of the different areas. So my slide beautifully lays out in shorthand, going from smaller to larger geographies, and from older geographies to newer geographies, and that things like electoral geographies and vital statistics, they use the same kind of thing. So roughly speaking, we go in a sort of census setting and other things from relatively small areas which might not have great socio-demographic detail, and we go sort of up the hierarchies, and we can often get greater detail for the larger geographies, but it's often the smaller area geographies we want the detail for, so we might be looking for change over time in those. So really that was just introducing some of the terms, things like lower super output areas and data zones and all that kind of thing. Is everybody reasonably familiar with the terminologies? Yeah? I think that's a really good question, Celia. In terms of electoral geographies, the Electoral Commission, the Boundary Commission, I can't remember exactly what goes on there, they would say they're consulting with sort of local authorities, they're looking at population change. So some of why we have a ward boundary change, we're supposed to have sort of equal counter-elector ratios within any one local authority. I'll say local authority, and are we happy that I don't have the Scottish terms right and different in Northern Ireland, local government. So some of the driving of why we have a ward boundary where it is actually population change. So if you have an increasing population, it changes the counter-elector ratio. So they move the boundaries to equalise the counter-elector ratio. So I do one piece of work for the Boundary Commission saying, do we have equality of representation? And roughly speaking, we do, but you have different systems in unitary authorities and metropolitan districts and things like that. So on the one hand, boundary change is there because population change, but then if you want to analyse the population change, I'm saying you need to have, you know, some kind of common framework of geography in order to do this. So the tail is wagging the dog, but you know, sometimes, you know, it's the same with census geographies. The small area census geographies are defined to give us the detail that we want, but there are thresholds of population and households such that they're as small as possible and all those kinds of things. Is that enough for now? Yes? Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, next time it dies, if somebody else can think of a question, we won't have questions at the end, we'll have questions as we go through. So that was rough, that there are relationships between these, that some of these things do nest into each other wholly, like Russian dolls and all that kind of thing, and often they don't, and it's the often they don't that I'm particularly interested in. So we might have, you know, how are we defining and having the information off the peg, as it were, to show how one geography relates to another, and that will normally be from one source to another source rather than necessarily across the sources. So more people will probably be familiar with the term lookup table, and it tends to be used for the small area membership of larger areas. It might be a list of postcodes, which I'll be talking about in a minute, and we'll say which areas those postcodes belong to. Well, if you are aggregating data from the smallest areas nested into the biggest areas, it's simply a summation, an aggregation, and it's a relatively simple thing to do. Okay, so most people will be familiar with a lookup table. Some of the older, like SASPAC and censuses, you used to actually look down. So if you are a big area, you want to know the constituent members of where you are. You might want to disaggregate the large area data for the small area data to smaller areas, but that's a sort of wing and a prayer of an estimation process that lots of people, including myself, will also do. But again, as a term, it's probably less well known to look across. And in a sense, this is where, you know, census ward boundaries change over time, or between postal and census. It's not an up or a down, it's just something across. It's not a dissimilar size, it's just different. So it's this look across, which in effect I'm going to be showing you how the boundary change stuff works. So we might be going from the smallest to largest areas in the lookup and all that kind of thing. This is more sort of what happens if these things misalign a bit or a lot. Again, I'm not going to talk about scale effects a great deal, but what scale you actually work at affects the amount of data preparation you have to do for a piece of work, the analyses that you find and the results and the interpretation. So this is Leeds, the wards, 30-odd wards, 400 and something lower super output areas, a sort of data zone-y sort of thing in that foreign country south of here, and output areas, the smallest areas. So that you would perhaps find different results at different scales relates to this thing called the modifiable aerial unit problem, and that any results are only applicable for the scale at which you carry them at. Again, I could be talking till next week about the modifiable aerial unit problem. Probably more people are familiar with that already. So, and we also should remind ourselves that the geography for which we get data does not necessarily of itself best represent that data. That, you know, the output area geography is not the area, it's not the geography of unemployment per se, even if we analyse unemployment for those output areas. Okay, so in terms of converting between geographies, so you've got data for two different geographies, what are you going to do with it? So, I'm terming the source geography as the aerial units for which the data pre-exist. The target geography are the aerial units for which you want the data to be in. And the intersection is the area defined variously of overlap between the source and the target unit. So source to target is what we're doing. And that, various guidelines, not sort of pirate's laws or whatever, but we have almost certainly, what I'm going to show you is a proxy variable to inform the conversion. And what you want for that proxy variable is that its distribution is related to the phenomenon of interest, which in my case is invariably socio-demographic data of some kind. So you want that proxy to be similar to your original data in some way, also to be close in time to the source data, and that it will enable linkage between the source and the target geographies, and we can achieve that using unit postcode locations. The conversion should be exhaustive, so no data are lost. So you take all the data in the source units, you don't want to lose any in the conversion process. So you want to make sure that you do have linkages between everything, and that the relationships between variables within the source geography should be effectively the same once you've converted the data, and do that checking correlations, for example, which I'll show you in a sec. Okay, so if we're doing these source-to-target conversions and apportioning data using polygon intersections, what is inappropriate is simply use the area of overlap. So the area of overlap between two polygons is not appropriate because population is not evenly distributed across any polygons. So there's a couple of techniques that have been used in the literature for quite a few years. One is called aerial interpolation, the other dasymmetric mapping. An aerial interpolation effectively weights things, often using population density to inform that. Dasymmetric mapping uses ancillary data on land use. So for example, you know, if something says, this is a school field, and some people live in some houses next door, and the polygon covers the whole lot, it says, you know, that's a school field, don't put anybody there because nobody lives there. So this proxy information used to determine the population distribution in the intersections, we can use unit postcode locations to inform this. And effectively, it's a hybrid of interpolation and dasymmetric approaches in that postcode distribution is a proxy for population distribution. You have more dense postcodes where more people live. And in terms of dasymmetric, effectively where a postcode is, where people live, and where a postcode isn't, people don't live. Now, it's not quite as simple as that, but you can take that as a reasonable assumption, even if it's not strictly true. Okay, so using postcode distribution to convert between vector geographies, distribution of unit postcodes, assumed to be a point in space, even though they're not quite, can be used. They are a decent proxy for population distribution. So what you can do is use existing resources. You don't have to go through the thing that I'm just about to describe. So on something like the National Statistics Postcode Directory, this is a lookup table which has therefore a long list of postcodes, and it has the alphanumerics of the different polygons that those postcodes are deemed to belong to. Same is also true, when you've broken it, of something called GeoConvert, which is a system at the University of Manchester whereby you can upload data for a particular geography and tell it what geography you want it for. The drawback with both of those sources, the National Statistics Postcode Directory or GeoConvert, is they don't have a full range of conversions that you might want. So, you know, what if you have geographies that these don't have them for? And the last time I talked to the people at Manchester about GeoConvert, they were struggling to get the funds to update it. So there we are. Owen, how are we doing? You're looking very warm.
Simple, same old. We're ready to go down the road.
Shall we move?
I think we should move because I think we'll do it again. Sorry about this, folks. The long one's got to change. We'll have to
complain about the long one. Yeah, maybe we need to project outside. Yeah. It needs a big red button. What's the button on the wall?
But it's a nightmare scenario that
we can get student hoodies for our students, obviously.
Yeah, it's good fun. Yeah. Also, they give them out free, so I walk around with my banner.
There's no pressure on me who holds the first thing. Take the opportunity to slope off then. Because that'd be good. This talk's really boring. I'm off. Okay, so what I was crashing on about before was there are some resources to do this by, but you might need to do this yourself, because whilst these are very good, they might not be comprehensive. So what I've got over here as the illustration of postcode distribution as a proxy for population distribution. So this is Well in Hatfield in 1991, and that is the 1991 residential postcode distribution. So I mean, these places which simply have more postcodes are the more urban areas, and vice versa where they're sparser. So that's in a sense of its crudest sort of description, the proxy for population distribution. Okay, so the sort of conversion process, the way that I've done this, is to say we want to move from the source geography to the target geography, and we're going to use the postcode distribution. So there's a set of postcodes there which are associated with this notional north ward, and there's a set here that are associated with this notional south ward. Over time, the boundary has changed such that we now have a west and an east, and this set of postcodes are associated with west, and this set are associated with east. So we can use those to convert. And if the population of North Ward was 9,000 people and South Ward was 6,000 people. What we do is we say that six of the postcodes that now belong to West Ward have come from North Ward and four of them have come from South Ward. So we're saying of the 9,000 we want 6 divided by 9, and of the 6,000 we want 4 divided by 6. So that apportions the data from the two bits up there to fit into this new bit here. Same for East, that 3 were associated with North, 2 were associated with South, so 3 divided by 9 of the 9,000 and 2 divided by 6 of the 6,000. We resum that up, which gives us 10,000 and 5,000. Not just using the postcode counts, but because you actually have more addresses per postcode in urban areas than rural, you can weight the postcode counts by the number of addresses at each to give a more sort of nuanced sort of calculation. Doesn't actually make a huge difference in the calculations at the end, but it just feels like you're using the data to the maximum. Is everybody reasonably okay on that? Yes? Everybody awake? Shall we move rooms yet?
Yes, so, an American question.
Yes.
So are postcodes...
Like zip codes?
Well, I knew that, but I mean, are they...
Are they
assigned roughly proportional to population? In other words, that seems to be your assumption, is that for M postcodes, they have one over N, each one over N.
Yeah, I think we say roughly sort of 20 to 24 addresses per postcode.
Okay.
Something like that on average. But in a rural area,
right,
it might be one or two farms.
Well, you'd expect fewer per address.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some of the precision can be better or worse in different kinds of places. So you wouldn't have one farm as having one postcode, and perhaps, well, you might do. I'm talking off the top of my head, but they might be half a mile apart. So some of the precision of a point, and it's the same with a street at, you know, Edinburgh level, that you might have one postcode that actually is quite a long way. It might cross a boundary. There's all sorts of things that are sort of somewhat imprecise about this, but it's the sort of principal idea. So, okay? So are zip codes located as points in space?
Yeah, it depends on the resolution. If you have a full nine-digit zip code, you can get to one side of the block. It's kind of like find a screen, so it's a
screen. Yeah. Good. Thank you. Everyone else okay? Yeah? Good. So, if you were to do this for yourself, and it's not two-layer, either GIS or statistical or whatever process, The best resource we now have is the National Statistics Postcode Directory. We've moved through various of these types of directories in the past, which we needn't worry about particularly. But what I would suggest is that you download a copy of this and select a subset of the postcodes which are timely to the source year. And what you have is what are called the dates of introduction and termination. So postcodes come and go. Aberdeen, for example, have wholesale postcode change. You'll find all the Aberdeen postcodes are in this directory. So if you use them all, you'd be having a weird distribution of postcodes. So the date of introduction termination is useful. Also, we have an indicator of whether people are large users, which implies some kinds of institutions, but mainly business premises. So what we want are residential postcodes, and retain the easting and northing, the XY and the address count. So what we then have is, for example, sort of that much, although we're not necessarily using that bit anymore. So if you open up that in a GIS and sort of map it as points using the easting and northing, and then associate those points with both the source and the target polygons. You can do that using spatial joins, pointed polygon, things like that. So what this is saying now, from the bit I retained from the original file, is for that particular postcode, it belongs to this particular area in 1991 and this particular area in 2001. So that's one of those places within Wellin Hatfield that changed its name and its arrangement of the boundaries. So we can do that for all of the points across the study area in which you're interested in. So in whether in a GIS or a stats software or database software, they can all do these sorts of things. You aggregate the count of the addresses across the source target intersections. So what this now shows, for example, is a particular ward called Haldens. So one set of postcodes and addresses still belongs to somewhere called Haldens, but it's a very large number of addresses. And then of the weight, 0.46, so 2,700 addresses lie within the intersection of Old Haldens and New Haldens. So 2,7 divided by 5,7 gives you a weight of 0.46 something or other. So nearly half the data, half the area of overlap, belongs to somewhere that's actually called the same place. There's a very itsy-bitsy change between Haldens and a place called Howlands, only 13 addresses, and so the area of overlap is only 0.023 from the source to the target. Haldens, this place called Panshanger, is again about half the area of overlap, and we've got another itsy-bitsy one here where Haldens overlaps with a very little bit of Wellin South. So 46 addresses out of the original 5.7 again gives a proportion overlap of 0.008.
Can I
Sia.
To go back, did that 46 addresses there in one postcode, is that by definition?
No.
No, right, sorry, no. I've missed something.
This is the aggregate bit, that's the line at the top. And where are we? Going in the right direction. So,
okay.
All of these, it's not a brilliant example, all of these belong to the same place at another time. So if you aggregate that lot, because that lot all belong there to there later. So what I'm doing is I'm squashing that lot. So where they're in common, that's the aggregation. Okay, so that's what aggregates the count of addresses across the source target. That's what it, so all the individual ones, you can lose that level of detail. Okay? So what this is saying is that this is the proportion of overlap between that original ward and what the new geography is. So that number of addresses falls in the intersections, and the proportion of the addresses is that. If it says 1, that means it overlaps entirely, or it belongs to, or whatever, or no boundary change. So the implication of this is Handside has had no boundary changes because it's a complete overlap. Okay, so anything here will sum to 1. They will sum to 1. And that gives this exhaustive, you know, everything will be transferred from the source to the target geography. Everybody got a picture of that enough? Okay, so this is then that little section from the previous slide of this Haldens ward, which gets apportioned to other places. So one of the things that you need to check is actually, are you finding the boundary changes? So are the postcodes doing that kind of job for you? Okay, so what we have, is that the right mouse? It is the right mouse. So that ward is Haldens, and that is the new ward, which is Panshanger. Okay, so lots and lots of postcodes belong to Haldens, lots and lots of postcodes belong to Panshanger. So this is saying about half the data gets allocated from the whole of Haldens into this bit, and into this bit. The other itsy-bitsy boundary changes are this bit, which is Wellin South. So the blue boundary is the 2001 boundary, the black-grey boundary is the 1991. So what we've got here is those 46 addresses, which belong to those, it looks like about 4 postcodes. That may not be entirely the case, but that would be about right. The 4 postcodes would be, say, 46 postcodes. So we are picking up the boundary change with those there. And again, this little segment down here, where there are only a very few postcodes and 13 addresses associated with those. So it's picking up that relatively small boundary change there. Just as another couple of observations, we've got this bit here where there is in fact only one postcode associated with the original 1991 ward, with this area over here, which is that Welland South. Now, I probably should have had this as an illustration, but if I take a 2001 postcode distribution, not the 1991 distribution, actually this area then has quite a few postcodes in it. So the boundary change has been driven by the population change. So there's been some new build there, some new postcodes introduced, which is why the boundary change was put in place by the local authority and the Boundary Commission. Since this is wards, it's therefore electoral process driven. And I said a few minutes ago, seems like hours ago now, that I had those wards which were in yellow, and I was saying there's no boundary change there. It wasn't until I did this last week or whatever that I actually noticed that there is a boundary change where I thought there was none. So I was mistaken in my observations in the past. Okay, so we've established that postcode distribution proxies population distribution, that it does pick up where there are boundary changes, and operationalising these conversion weights from the source to the target geography. So we should check that the process works in terms of our relationships maintained. So something that we might quite regularly do in a sort of health geography setting is look at the relationship between deprivation and mortality. So the data here have come from the 1991 census and the four variables that are inputs to the Townsend deprivation scheme, and 1991 mortality data, all cause, males and females together from the vital statistics. So what I'm going to do is investigate the relationship in the original 1991 ward geography to convert all these 1991 variables, the numerators and denominators, and the mortality to the 2001 geography, and then look at the relationships of this 1991 data in the new geography and see how similar it is. So what the top section of that table is a correlation matrix between mortality rates with unemployment, non-homeowners, overcrowded households, people who don't have access to a car, and Townsend deprivation score. So, and we have all these interrelationships between those variables there. So we have a set of correlations between all those variables. It doesn't sort of need the sort of analysis of those as such now, and given that we've had the delays, we'll be here till 3 o'clock anyway. So there were 9,424 wards in England and Wales in 1991. In 2001, there were 8,850 wards, so we've actually lost some in the process with all the boundary changes that have gone on. So this then is a correlation matrix in equivalent of all those older data converted to the 2001 geography. And here there is just the difference between the two, one subtracted by the other. And effectively, we just look across this lot, the differences are incredibly slight. And again, so relationships are maintained when you convert between the geographies. So you're not actually introducing or changing the relationships in converting between the geographies. Okay, there are some measures that we can use to assess goodness of fit, so measures of uncertainty. And one measure is called the degree of hierarchy, and the other is the degree of fit. And the degree of hierarchy looks at the proportion of the source units which are wholly contained within a single target unit. So this really suits the sort of hierarchical relationship where you have smaller areas that fit into larger areas. And it's looking for where that weight in the conversion is 1. So what proportion of units does that 1 occur in? The degree of fit looks at the largest amount of population overlap between the source and target units. And effectively what this is showing is the proportion of data which is not subject to estimation. So it's the bit which is just transferred straight from one to the next, the proportion that is that. And in many ways, this is a sort of fairer assessment of when we have, say, a look across from wards of different years or between postal and census geographies, you know, those sorts of relationships where areas are similar in size but differently defined. So what we have between the 1991 census and wards and the 2001 wards, the degree of hierarchy, so the proportion of areas where is the weight of one, so it's a direct transfer, is just over 50%. So that is either no boundary change or when a larger area was defined later on. So the degree of hierarchy is not a very good fit, but we wouldn't really expect it to be given the relationship of the geographies. The degree of fit, which I think is a fairer assessment of these sort of look-across relationships, so the maximum overlap of 8,348, which is calculated from the maximum weight, so we've actually got a degree of fit of about 88%, which means that 12% of the data have been estimated. Now, some of that sort of quite reasonable thing is actually we have fewer wards in 2001 than we did in 1991. So just because we have fewer areas means they're slightly larger on average, which means there is a fair area of overlap. So what this is, just changing the geographies ever so slightly, is the goodness of fit between the 1991 enumeration districts in England and Wales and the various 2001 geographies. So what we have between EDs in 91 and output areas in 2001 is our degree of hierarchy is very, very low. But given that we actually had many more OAs in 2001 than we did in EDs in 1991, that would be expected. And the degree of overlap in effect, degree of fit, is somewhat better, but again, they are a radically different geography, so we wouldn't really expect that degree of fit to be high anyway. So the warning there is if you're going to try and convert enumeration district data to output areas and have some kind of meaningful output that you have trust in, actually, you should be very sceptical. Okay, it will convert the data, you will see a reasonable socio-demographic geography emerging, but there's a lot of estimation involved. Then as you move sort of up the hierarchies, given that there are no direct relationship between LSOAs and wards, so the degree of hierarchy and degree of fits all gradually improve, such that when you move to local authority districts, where you are going from very small areas to much larger areas, there is much, much less estimation involved. So basically, as you go to larger geographies from smaller geographies, it is a more reliable process. Something which I've not done before is compare with the truth. And one of the major reasons not for doing that is the truth is elusive. That if you had the data reallocated for a new geography, you wouldn't be needing to convert. However, I did manage to persuade ONS to do this. One of the reasons that they are unwilling to do this is differencing. That if they say, look, you've got the original geography, you've got the new geography, the slivers will perhaps start pushing the confidentiality boundary. But in this case, I managed to persuade them to let me have some data. So what I've got here is the counts of 1991 mortality across deprivation quintiles, so fifths of the deprivation distribution in 1991. So those are the counts of the number of mortality events in 1991 across that. So if we then take just crude mortality rate divided by the number of persons, we then have the sort of gradient of mortality such that it's lower in the less deprived quintile 1 and higher in the more deprived towards quintile 5, so you can probably imagine, you know, the gradient of that going on. So what I've then done is converted the 1991 mortality into the 2001 geography, and again aggregated the mortality across 2001 calculated deprivation quintiles. And what we have here, this is what I mean by exhaustive, that we actually have the same number of mortality events. We haven't lost any, we haven't gained any. It's the same data, it all gets transferred. It's a reliable process in that way. And if we look at my estimated rates for the new geography, they are telling you the same story that is. I haven't bothered to put confidence intervals on this, but they are, you would not conclude something different during that conversion process. We have the same kind of gradient between the less and the more deprived areas. So what this particular bit here is the ONS allocation of mortality from 1991 to the 2001 geography, so then aggregated across the deprivation quintiles. And one of the things about the truth is it's a different truth because we actually have fewer mortality events, and some of that is because ONS were unable to allocate some because the postcodes were missing and that kind of thing. So there is a small amount of difference from the ONS file that they provided me. But if we then look at the difference in rates, yes, there are, you know, some minor differences, but not enough that you would make any different conclusion about the gradient of mortality from less to more deprived areas. Something I'd like to pursue more is comparisons with the truth, if I can get some more data to do that with. Okay, so one of the things that I've been doing over the last year or so is converting data from various censuses across GB from 1971 through to 2011 to look at how areas are changing over time. So having this sort of bank of data for a consistent geography means you can then look at particular places and see how they've changed over time. So the example at the top there is Milton Keynes. Milton Keynes was founded in 1967, and the taking of the 1971 census, Milton Keynes hadn't really started to be built by then. So what you're actually looking at there is actually what was a predominantly village and rural area, but those are the 2011 LSOAs that the data have been converted to look at deprivation. So what's quite interesting to me is that this sort of south end of the local authority is where sort of city centre, if it is a city, I can't remember, and the residential areas. And you immediately move into the darker colours, which are the more deprived areas, which then become slightly more focused over time. And a slight bit of spread out of the deprivation by 2011. So very quickly in Milton Keynes, it establishes itself with a sort of urban core of more deprived areas, such that many urban areas in the UK are. So it did that really, really quickly with the sort of social sorting pretty much straight away. But you could take this type of thing and look at some kind of analysis over time. This bottom left is just another example. The areas in red between 1971 and 2011 are those LSOAs which are most deprived, quintile 5, over time. The green areas here are those which were non-deprived over time. Anywhere white has got slightly less deprived over time, and these blue areas have actually got slightly more deprived over time. So we've got a sort of suburban ring, particularly in these sort of northern, western, whatever areas, which have got somewhat more deprived over time. So we can actually see that happen. And again, by having the infant mortality data for a consistent geography over time, we can look at how rates of infant mortality in general have fallen, but the inequalities between the most and the least deprived areas
have anything increased over time. But part of what's going on here is I've aggregated all the births and deaths to infants aged less than 1 year across the same deprivation over time. So I've just taken 2001 deprivation and aggregated the rates across that over time. And that's something which I'm beginning to believe is an inappropriate way of analysing things. Okay, before I move on to individual stuff, has anybody got any questions or queries on what I've done so far? Are we all still awake? Do we need to go for another walk? Great, okay, everybody all right on that? Yeah? Okay, so if we have some individual level data, cases of something or other, it doesn't really matter what, and we might quite regularly, in my line of business, be associating those cases of whatever with deprivation. Does this particular disease or whatever relate to deprivation? On what scale we choose to link to will affect what data gets attached to those individuals. So the red areas are the most deprived, the white areas are average, and the blue areas are less deprived. So we've got our ward geography, our most detailed output area geography, and we've got our LSOA geography. So sort of top right, or northeast, is Wetherby, which is it would be considered to be a relatively well-off area outside of Leeds. And if we were to attach all this lot, all these people would be linked to a relatively non-deprived area. If we were to do that for output areas, we've actually got a little splodge of red in there, quintile 5, the most deprived. I don't know whether there are any cases, but it sort of looks like possibly some might be. We've got a somewhat deprived area there, and so on. And different still for the LSOAs. So, if we choose a particular scale, we're going to get a somewhat different result. How much it matters, you need to sort of go through the whole process and reanalyze the data depending. So scale effects, modifiable aerial unit problem, as I said a while ago, have had a fair amount of coverage in the sort of epidemiology and health geography sort of literature, which is reasonably well covered, I think. However, we quite often have data for people over time, or we're looking at areas over time, and we might be looking at people's movements through their lives, through different kinds of places, whether it's deprivation space or population densities and things like that. So actually capturing people's change in residential location is another challenge to this consistent geography type arena. So the simplest thing you can do, which is sort of my infant mortality thing, although that was just about areas, it wasn't individuals, is just to aggregate your data across one time point of deprivation, say, or could be population density or whatever. So you just take all your data over time, you link it to one geography, one set of deprivation, and go about your business doing that. Something else which people do is to say, well, I'll group my records around, which are relevant to the nearest census, could be 1981, 1991, 2001, and I'll just pool them for that period, and I'll just do my deprivation calculation for the geography of the time, different geography, and do my interpretations based on that. Or if it's a longitudinal or cohort study, say, oh, somebody around this time lived in an area that was a bit like this, later on they lived in an area that was a bit like this and a bit like this. So what I'm interested in is, does it make any difference whether you do this in the simplest possible way, a somewhat simple way, and a more complicated way, which is to create these consistent geographies and comparable deprivation measures, which is the sort of thing that I'm interested in doing. So effectively, as far as I'm concerned, if you have the same geographic framework and if you have a deprivation score which is goes up or down in time and it has an associated logical meaning, the area becomes more deprived, less deprived, whatever, that you can make an interpretation because you have everything on the same geographic footing, as it were. So what this comes from is a diabetes register that colleagues I've worked with at Leeds in epidemiology have, and this is type 1 diabetes for persons aged 0 to 14, diagnosed over a period of time to register between 1978 and 2003. And this work is actually published, Katie Harron, myself and some others, a few years ago. So I've revisited the data set because I'm interested in testing what's going on with this. If you make different choices, does it matter? Would you conclude differently? And so on. So for the sake of the sort of pooling argument of putting things around a particular census, the green dots are the cases from around 1981, so from a bit before to just a bit after. Similarly for 1991 in blue and 2001 in green. The screen drawing obviously masks some of them. And you sort of glance at it and you think from what we can see, given things are superimposed on top of each other, actually the geography of those dots doesn't appear to markedly change over time, and it probably doesn't particularly, but again, that's something I yet want to do. So if we have our deprivation for each of these years, in the geography of each of these years, so that, for example, is the 1991 wards and deprivation in 1991. Actually, it's something I should point out. The reason there's a big gap here is this is the old Yorkshire region of health services, so there aren't actually any data for that particular area there. But this is then Yorkshire and Humber, as in the Government Office Region designation around 2001. So again, less deprived is blue, average is white, national average that is, approximately, and more deprived is red. So we have the sort of West Yorkshire, South Yorkshire, old industrial areas down here, which are the relatively deprived areas, and North Yorkshire, the more rural Yorkshire Dales, etc., is relatively less deprived, as a sort of sweeping statement. And that's Hull over here, which is relatively deprived. So if we take our 1991 data, such as I showed you a few minutes ago, and convert that all to the 2001 geography, because of the boundary changes and some other reasons, actually the map seems to change a little bit. So we sort of blew up North Yorkshire a bit, apparently, as it is quite blue in the other senses too. But we have got some differences. And some of that is because of boundary change and the recalculation and so on. It's not so much about the accuracy of these things. So what I'm doing then is attaching the data for the cases of diabetes to the different geographies of deprivation. So what the top bit up there is then saying is attaching the individual records to the geography of each time point, and they're just looking at the distribution across deprivation. So the top bit there, top left, is the 1981 distribution for the 1981 geography. Then the 1991 approximate distribution pulled for the 1991 geography, and then pulled across the 2001 geography. What this bottom bit here then is just attaching every record to the 2001 geography, so the simplest way of going about this. And then the one in the middle is the harmonised, everything harmonised to 2001 and the comparable deprivation over time. And what we can actually see is not a huge amount of difference, to which you say, why the hell did you bother to do that if there isn't a difference? But actually, until I did that, I didn't know that there wasn't going to be a huge amount of difference. And what we also have is rather a strange distribution across deprivation, that we don't have a sort of gradient. We might expect more people to live in the more urban areas, we might expect health to be worse in the more deprived areas, all that kind of thing. But we have actually got something about, I was trying to work out how I could do a graph, the Lenny Henry sort of, but it does seem to be a sort of spike around quintile 2 and a spike around quintile 5, and that is sort of roughly reproduced for all of these ways of going about things. And that actually ties in with the findings of the particular paper, that the sort of risk factors for type 1 diabetes, there wasn't a clear relationship at individual level with area deprivation, and that sort of bears out when you look at things like that. So that's three ways. I can probably think of 33 ways of skinning the cat, as it were, to do that. But roughly speaking, you're not introducing error by converting between the geographies. It's still the same thing had you analyse things in a cross-sectional kind of way. So to sort of summarise some of this, so much work uses one cross-section of deprivation and presumes that this applies over time. But what this doesn't account for is that areas change. Some places get less deprived, there's gentrification, there's urbanisation, there's all sorts of processes going on, which you really should be capturing in the work that you're doing. And if the geography of the time point is used, the measures themselves may not be comparable, because the deprivation distribution is sensitive to the number of aerial units. So you have 9,000 and something wards and 8,000 and something wards. The geography will be different simply because you're slicing the cake differently. So if you have a consistent geography used, then the deprivation changes can be related to outcome changes because you're capturing the deprivation in a common kind of way. It is a much better framework to work in. Your database or your stats software or whatever, it can be just one database to do this with, rather than have to do it in three different ways or whatever. I think one of the reasons why my particular example here, you would say you wouldn't conclude any differently given the three ways I've cut the cake to show you how to do this. I think that's largely because deprivation differences between areas are largely entrenched. So this is just looking at the consistent deprivation over time. So that's sort of a Milton Keynes example, but for the whole of GB, that between 1971 and 81 was a 0.88 correlation of deprivation over time. 71 to 91.8, 71 to 2001, 0.79, and actually that maintains through to 2011. So really the geography, the social geography like this, is pretty consistent over time. Okay, so in terms of area data, where I started out, my mission to students, whatever, knowing about the geography of data collection to some degree, but the geography of data release is paramount to doing a decent piece of work, and it's as important as knowing your data types as to what method you then go on and use. If the data for the same work are available for non-hierarchical geographies, i.e. if they are hierarchical, it's easy to move between small and large areas. You can use the National Statistics Postcode Directories to do the lookups. You don't have to do the GIS stuff. If they have the geographies you're interested in, GeoConvert is very, very good, but again, it's rather restricted on the time frame of the conversions that you can do. You might need to devise your own conversions. Some of the GIS stuff is actually not at the techie end of GIS by any means. So if you use postcode address counts to inform the conversions, they do identify where the boundary changes have occurred and can be used to estimate the intersection between zones. The postcode distribution does relate to population distribution simply because you get more postcodes where there are more people. By careful selection and logic of the NSPD, you can make things year specific and for assumed to be residential postcodes, and that when you convert data between geographies, you do maintain relationships between variables, and actually the raw counts themselves are pretty reliable too. There is some difference, but it's not huge. In terms of individual data, if you've got some kind of phenomenon geocoded by postcodes, you can link those to areas. The choice of scale will affect the results. But if you're doing something that's either time series or longitudinal, perhaps using our longitudinal studies or so on, some of these data sets, the LS, SLS and the NILS, for example, have some pre-existing or user-supplied area characteristics. Sometimes that's an urban-rural classification, that kind of thing. It may be for the geography of each census. It may be for a common geography framework. And it's common to carry out some kind of time series or longitudinal analysis with data aggregated to just 1 year of area characteristics. I don't believe that's sufficient to capture area change, for example. So having data for successive census, in brackets because it could be other things, time points harmonised to one geography, it captures the area change, such as deprivation, but particularly population density. Now, if you've got a boundary change, somebody's living somewhere, they've got bigger or smaller, they're apparently living in a more or less densely populated area, which may not actually be true. And once the data prep is done of that, the framework analysis is much more straightforward. You can incorporate changes going on or precursor conditions that somebody's lived through or something like that. So that's it, apart from boundary change in fiction. So that's where I got the Cheshire Cat from. And you can drag yourself through that. That's quite an amusing paragraph I found in the book. So. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for enduring the wanderings. Questions? Jim?
A question about wards, again, from an uninformed American perspective. They sound like they're roughly equivalent to congressional districts in that they're assigned according to population they're supposed to be.
Yes, that they're a relatively local geography. One of the drawbacks of electoral wards is they can vary in population size between 500 people and 20,000 people.
Oh, wow. Okay. So orders of magnitude.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why from 2001 our census and administrative geographies at below local government area have been predominantly these things called super output areas and data zones, which are much more even in their population size and are designed for the release of census and other data rather than being tagging on to a geography defined for the electoral process. But wards are, one of the reasons I've used it in this is because they have been what has been used an awful lot in the past. My more recent work, like that Milton Keynes time frame, is using what are called lower super output areas, but I've used data zones in Scotland for that work. So to use a contemporary geography, so I've gone from old geographies to contemporary geographies. But yes, whenever you write something and submit it to a journal, it's trying to make it, you know, digestible to an international audience, and one would write, this is equivalent to where you know.
So. One of the reasons for asking that is that although there is a constraint of roughly equivalent population for congressional districts, they obviously get wildly gerrymandered for political purposes.
Yes.
And I was wondering if there's a similar thing at work here.
Well, the Boundary Commission and Electoral Commission are supposed... can you remember what their official designation is? It's like a government agency that isn't. They're supposed to be independent. Well, here we go. Quango sort of thing. There hasn't been an awful lot of accusation of gerrymandering within local government and the electoral system in the UK. There was a Liverpool example a few years ago. Anybody remember? Somebody ended up in court for redefining the boundaries for their electoral gain or something.
But there is an officially independent entity.
Yes.
That are supposed
yes.
To okay, that's so that.
Yes.
Different.
Yes. 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 To try and alleviate that particular problem. But the US terminologies of redistricting and there's a malapportionment. It's the same. It's the same stuff. Except why are you doing it? And people will do it for different reasons.
I wonder if for more actual data for maybe future censuses or 2011 data have you looked at the results, and do they match with your previous results? Or
you mean in terms of my comparisons of area over time or method? Yes, I mean in terms of deprivation change, generally 2011 comes out using Townsend as slightly more deprived than 2001. I suspect a lot of that is I know that a lot of that is driven by fewer people in 2011 owning their houses, so more are renting than there were in 2001. So some of that might be buy-to-let, or it might be the economy, that younger people are not getting on the housing ladder as much as they used to. And part of my aims for when I redid the Townsend over time, because I did it by wards before in previous work, and I've fairly recently done this for LSOA's data zones, which Alastair knows and nobody else did. So I've updated the work and used a different geography, so I found that, and what I wanted then to do was adjust Townsend scores or the inputs to be, say, public housing, not just non-home ownership, because private rental is perhaps not the marker of deprivation as perhaps it was when Townsend first invented his scheme. So I had wanted to do something different. So yes, I found something different, which is 2011 slightly more deprived than 2001, but I'm not actually believing that's really deprivation. I think that's just the state of the economy and housing markets and things.
Do you actually use the postcode points, or do you ever use the actual, like, the postal address file points, for example, where you actually have a point for each house?
Yes, I've never had a very large coverage address file personally,
right, okay.
But I've had extracts, and Ludy Simpson, who's done very similar work, did actually have a larger framework file, and in fact, he found there was no gain in this informing boundary change and apportioning. The overlap type thing.
And even not if you can, like, strip out, for example, non-residential addresses.
Okay, so I think it's one of these things that non-residential can be tricky in some circumstances, in that the whole of Lancaster University is one postcode, and it's down as a large user.
Right.
But patently, a lot of people, including my daughter at one stage, lived there. So you can have the same with armed forces bases, you can have the same with some care homes, that you can also have where the accountant's address is down as a residential or a business. So there are all sorts of subtleties of this which are imperfect. But what it does do is this sort of saying, it's not a broad brush, it's better than that. But there are, there are occasions when it can't be the truth. But the tests that I've done and somebody else has done are saying, do you actually do this better by having address points? Is it no better? If you actually really knew the purpose of the address, that might improve things more. If you don't strip out large user postcodes, you end up with a lot more data in town centres than you should do. And most town centres are, you've got flats above the shops here, that isn't unusual. But they would have different postcodes. Your point is a good one. And it's something that I don't think it improves, but I suspect if we knew more about the actual usage, that would improve things further. Yeah.
Question here. One more.
Yes. I just want to come back actually on something you said just now, because having got to this stage, it's really interesting the way that you're developing ways now of classifying areas in a consistent way over time, geographically.
Yes.
But you're making the point that then we have to think about how we classify them in terms of what's actually changing in those areas.
Yes.
And the trend may not be consistently in one direction or another or stable. So I don't know whether, quite what my question is, but I suppose what I wondered was whether you're moving now towards classifications of areas which might encapsulate those longitudinal trends, which we know from ourselves is actually quite a powerful predictor of something.
Yes, yes. I've got a couple of things like that. One of the problems, I mean, these were just rough geographies. I didn't realise that I'd actually done them as fives. One, two, three. They are fives. That's not implying quintiles. But this does actually illustrate one of the problems, that if you... One of the difficulties of the change over time, and maybe if I go to... Yes, is this. So... These areas were quintile 5 in 1971 and in 2011. Okay, I've got nothing in that map is in between. It's simply start, finish. And same for these, they just are more. These were less deprived and these were quintile 1 at both time periods. When you categorise like that, you have a sort of modifiable categorical unit problem. What I've actually started experimenting with, and I'm not even sure it's an answer to your question, is actually a k-means classification, so a geodemographic classification, of all the z-scores that are the inputs. So 71, 4, 4, 4, 4, 4, however many it is, and saying, collapse those into group memberships of trajectory of change. So ignoring the quintiles, because that actually is quite cumbersome as a framework of analysis. It's all right, that's very easy. You just take all the data and put it across one set of quintiles, and you get a clear picture, but I don't know whether that being broader there than there is simply because that's closer to the distribution of deprivation at that time point and the geography. You know, some of the variation is because there is some error in the process. There's all sorts of things going on, but actually picking up change, it's like, how do you measure that change? Now, if you go to the Townsend score in the way that I've calculated, and you have to codicil everything I've said, but calculate it in this way. So if it becomes more positive, that means it's got more deprived over time. If it's become more negative, that's less deprived over time. The problem with the measure is that unemployment sort of does that. Car ownership does that. Household overcrowding sort of... Actually, household overcrowding has gone up slightly by 2011. And what's the other one? The other one. No car, household overcrowding, home ownership, whatever. But in general, more people own their homes. In general, fewer overcrowded homes. In general, more people have a car. So... It's sort of the most variant of census time points is the unemployment, but it misses the bits in between. But actually capturing the area change and that it's you cross a categorical boundary is therefore a step change. And then you're down to all the problems of, you know, that Martin Senior was talking about Jarman years ago and, you know, funding. But I'm, you know, really, I mean, it's a great query that you have.
Challenges one.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, yeah. It's a good point, even though you're struggling to make it because it's not an easy point to make.
But you've got the answer.
Yeah.
What I mean.
Yeah. I hope so. Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Should we
have a? No, I was going to
give a great. Well. It's 3 o'clock. It looks like it might have cooled down outside, so we can go and test the other projector. No, let's not do that.
Are we way over time?
No, I think we're okay. I think everyone's gone home now. Unless there's any final questions, so we can let you off the hook. Well, just before we say final thank you. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for badly trotting between rooms, putting up with that. I will now go with evidence to ask again for the...
Do we need a petition?
But thank you for coming, especially in the middle of the day. Well, it's almost knocking off time, but so if you don't have to rush back to the office, there are, or should be, I hope, still some refreshments next door, so do come and help. Well, tidy those away by drinking them. So thank you once again for coming this year, and well, a new programme will be up soon, but for the moment, just remains to thank Paul for a very interesting talk. It's quite good. Thank you.